We're not really fighting, guys. Mom and Dad are perfectly happy. Welcome back to the Lazy Muse Podcast. I'm Jimmy G.
And I am Eric Grattan.
We'll be talking about Game of Thrones, Season 3, Episode 5, Kissed by Fire.
And we will soon have a different opening salvo with one of these episodes. We're going to get through these Game of Thrones things and then That's get right. on to some other bulls.
Some other juicy stuff.
Yes.
So this was this episode was written by Alex Graves. This episode was directed by Alex Graves and written by our usual suspects, D.B. Weiss and David Benioff. So a new little thing we want to throw out there. Right at the top, we're going to tell you what we thought about the show. And we're going to give the episode to one of the houses, the house we think won the game.
For that week.
For that week. So I'll go ahead and start. I'm going to give this to House Tyrell. So I'm going to give it 3 roses. And I'm going to do that because of the scene we'll talk about in just a little bit with Tyrion. So who would you give it to?
Oh, no, I know exactly the scene you're talking about. It's one of the ones that I've been waiting for, the way that you talk often about the scenes you've been waiting for years. This is one I wanted to see. My problem with this thing is I can see myself week after week after week after week giving it to House Tyrell, because any time the Queen of Thorns shows her face, anytime we see Diana Rigg, I am going to want to give the entire episode to them because she is so good and the character is so fun. So I'm also going to give the House Tyrell, but screw it, I'm going to have 4 roses. Four roses.
So you're giving the episode 4 roses.
I am, because I've been waiting for that scene.
So you really enjoyed it. Well, I can't wait till we get into this. So in the title sequence, and this is something I guess we haven't actually talked about, it pans over the map of Westeros, and we get to
endpoints other,
and it's interesting because it always gives you a clue as to new places we might be visiting.
Right.
And
I want to talk for a second. You say Westeros. And
yes.
And I think this is another one of those examples of deciding whether we want to use the pronunciation that the show uses,
yes,
or use the pronunciation that is in our own head from reading the books for so many years.
So what was in your head, Eric?
No, I think they say on the show Westeros.
Oh.
I think they say that and not Westeros.
Westeros.
I'm pretty sure that's what they're saying.
Because of the OS?
I don't know, just because that's the way they say it.
Westeros.
I'm just telling you. I always said Westeros in my head as well.
It's hard. You know, for years I refused to say Zagat.
Right, because it's Zagat.
Because I thought Zagat just, you know, was trippingly off the tongue.
Yes.
But I guess I'm going to have to go with Westeros.
I think so, dude.
So.
My dad says Chevy Chase when he's talking about the actors, so neither here nor there.
All right. So we are introduced to a new location on the map. And this is going to be another one of those things. How do you say it? Yonkai.
Sure. I'll go with that.
All right. We're going to say Yonkai.
I think I did Yonkai in my head.
Yonkai. And listen, anytime you want to correct us, please just go to your email and type in theverylazymuse@gmail.com and send us whatever you want.
Oh, yeah. Abuse us.
Abuse us. Compliment us. Give us ideas. It doesn't matter. Send it to theverylazymuse@gmail.com, and we'll read it right here on our little podcast.
Extra points for every apostrophe put in the wrong place.
Right. We will not read it if you use the word irregardless, though.
Or supposedly.
Supposedly. So exciting things to come, because some pretty cool things happen on the way to Yonkai. And
Yonkai.
And I can't wait to see what comes of it. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was agreeing with you, propping you up.
I love that.
Listeners.
I love that. So scene one, we have the challenge by fire.
Oh, yeah.
And this is just a fantastic opening when Lord Beric Dondarrion just cuts the sword across his hand and the blood just ignites it into fire.
Yes. We've been reading about the flaming swords of the Red Priests for a while, so this is nice to see.
Right. And I don't know. Did they show this in season one at the Turning of the Hand?
They did not.
Okay, so this is something that Theros of Myr did. It was a little parlor trick of his. That he would, in all the melees, and he beat Gregor Clegane.
Yeah, I would say melee.
Well, I don't know if that's actually a debatable one. That's just me saying the word wrong.
Hey, sure.
So melee?
Yeah.
Okay, so at the melee, which is a bunch of guys just sort of random, they're attacking each other.
Every
man for himself. And it was actually Theros who beat Sander, the Hound, yes, at the Tournament of the Hand for Eddard Stark. And one of the things is he had this this flaming sword that he always had, except that it was really just a parlor trick. He would put some fire on there. And this, it seems like magic.
Well, just wave your hand in front of your face. Magic.
Right. Magic. It was a pretty good fight. Well choreographed, and
I think so. I always have an issue with how slow broadsword or longsword fights start out. Yeah, I can understand them getting slow as you go, but I think you want to end it quick.
Right.
I want a broadsword fight to start out fast and
right,
gain slowness with respect and
well, and it's hard
when
work.
The combatants grow tired. Yeah.
It's hard work. So, I mean, that was one of the best fight scenes I've ever seen was in Rob Roy.
Oh,
and the reason was is because it wasn't, expert fighting all the way through. They were taking breaks and stopping because it really is exhausting work trying to kill somebody.
Well, and if you haven't seen it, I'm sure most of you have. But, Rob Roy came out the same year as Braveheart and is, in my opinion, a much superior film.
Agreed.
The cast is incredible, the acting's incredible, and the fight scenes are really brilliant.
But they don't have anybody from this series in that show, in Rob Roy, right?
I have not double-checked.
In Braveheart, we know for sure they do.
Oh, yeah.
At least
of course
the one.
They do.
Okay, so a great, great fight scene.
There's two more seasons, by the way, and Tim Roth is bound to make it.
Right.
They got to get more and more famous than the guest stars. That's a rule in television.
So the fight scene is great. In the fire, immediately you see the reaction from the Hound when he sees the fire. This is an aversion he's had since his asshole big brother pushed him into a fire as a kid.
Right.
But he wins this fight fair and square. I mean, he beats
Dondarrion. Dondarrion in twain.
Right, right.
Myr in twain.
So then we see a little bit of the prayer. I mean, Theros immediately jumps on him, starts doing his little prayer.
Oh, yeah.
And he comes back pretty quick.
Oh, yeah. No, this is some magic CPR. This is, it goes right in there and there he is. He does the,
right. Right.
I just want to see him cough up a little water and, then we're good.
Right. So, I mean, what did you think about that? Because this is certainly in the book, but it never stuck with me in the book the way the show brought it to me, where it was so immediate. And, this is one of those instances for me where magic kind of slipped through the cracks, where it's like, oh, yeah, I was aware of it, but I didn't see just how big it was.
Sure. What struck me about it on television was how matter-of-fact it was. He didn't come to the way the zombies do on Walking Dead, or the way he was dead, and then he was up and walking around.
Right,
and that was pretty cool.
And looking good.
Yeah, looking pretty good.
I mean, he couldn't move his arm. Yeah, it's so still there.
Scars from the five other times this has happened to him.
Right. So let's do a little magic check-in here.
Hey, shall we?
It would seem to me that out of all the religions we've been introduced to, which is we have,
the seven,
the Lord of Light,
right?
The old gods, which so if we go back, the Lord of Light is Theros of Myr, Melisandre, these type of people, Rolar. Yeah, right, Rolar.
Yeah, there's an apostrophe in there that makes it difficult.
Right. Then we have the Seven, which are the new gods, and that's like Catelyn Stark, and really most of
the Southlands,
South right. Lord. The Westeros, right, the Southrod. And then we have the old gods, which is like Eddard Stark. So these are those white trees with the bled red leaves and stuff. And then who's the Children of the Forest?
Right.
Are I guess the guy, they're like a people, right. Not really a religion themselves. But out of all of these, really Rolar is the one who's stepping up to say, "Hey, I got some skills here. Yeah. I got some magic.
I got mad hops."
But so what about Dany? I mean, Dany walks into a gigantic pyre,
right.
Stays there all night. I mean, she stays there until this gigantic fire burns itself into nothing but smolders and comes out with three baby dragons.
Yeah.
It's a big dose of magic there. But yeah, I mean, so what is that? I mean, she's definitely not Lord of the Light people, but we don't hear her say anything about, you know, the Seven or old gods. Yeah,
and we're forgetting the Dothraki have their own. You know, it is
right. That's right. We haven't seen their magic though.
It's some sort of Valyrian religion thing.
Okay. So a yet undisclosed. I mean, have we not?
Sort of. I mean, you know, don't forget we also have the pyromancers and we have the
right.
The what were the blue-lipped guys back in the day?
Oh, right.
You know,
I forget their name. The Undying.
Thank you. Yes, the House of the Undying has its own weird religious magic.
Right, and they were like. It seems like parlor tricks, really. But, I mean, in the shows, obviously, they can, like, teleport.
Yeah, they can do some stuff.
Because they're, like, the little kid jumps around from space to space.
Don't forget the Dar-Harris stuff, the many faces.
Oh, right, so right.
That's another of the religions. In the
right, world. And that's...
got some skills here.
Right, that's a very exciting storyline that
yes.
We can't talk about, but it's one of my favorite.
Yes, I skipped ahead a little. Apologize to almost no one because shut up and
right.
Listen.
Enjoy so, yourself. Magic count, we have really, we still have the Rolar in first place.
Yes.
Because probably. He's, and then I guess the old gods have a little bit to claim in the wargs because,
yes.
You know, the Stark kids are having some, a little bit of magic there.
And the heart trees and stuff will play a little bit more as we move along.
Right.
Teacher, alert.
Right.
Teaser alert, heart trees. Two seasons.
So, Eric, here we go to the scene two. Booty time for John.
Yeah. No, that young. I guess I always assume that the old gods, you know, make you feel guilty. So it's always to me.
Yeah, man.
Gods.
It's like Catholics. Yeah, pop that Catholic cherry. Thing. Pop that cherry.
Yeah, and feel incredibly guilty about it. You know, luckily he met a young woman who.
Yeah.
Who looks upon it with a much more enlightened
one of view. Several ass shots.
Yes, there's a lot of butt in this particular.
And I looked this up. The gal who played Ygritte, that's her real ass.
Well done.
It was not John's ass.
He had a double.
He had a double because he injured his leg. So he had a cast on, which you can't see when he's in the full furs. But when you know, he's stripped down. There it was. Ask double for Jon Snow.
Disappointed in you, Jon Snow.
You know
Snow.
Nothing, Jon Snow.
That's right.
But, you know, we got some booty time. I mean, and this was, you know.
So, of course, my girlfriend walked into the room while I was watching this scene. Looked at the screen, looked at me, nodded knowingly.
Right.
Chuckled on her way out of the room.
Right. Did you say, it's not incest boobies?
No, I can't win. I can't win. I think the thing, and you know, I'm a big fan of sexuality and entertainment and exploring stuff like that. But I really gotta say, for the most part, I am not impressed with the use of nudity on this show, and that will not be a popular stance among a certain
right.
segment of the population.
Right. That's...
But I just think most of the nudity in this show so far is pretty ridiculously unnecessary. It's there to show boobs and get people to watch it who aren't going to
watch
it.
You might as well have just told me the sun is cold.
I know.
That's how outrageous of a statement that sounds to me.
I just, you know, sue me. I want my nudity to have bearing on the characters and relationships involved.
Oh, it's so
I
heady.
Want it to be a storytelling device that is effectively used. Because when we arouse our audience, we make them think interesting thoughts. So let's make them think interesting thoughts about the story and the character and not just random movies. All right, moving on. Talk about how much you like the movies. Enjoy your time.
It's always important.
Yes.
It's natural, Eric.
Yeah, well, I'm not arguing that. I'm just arguing that no.
It's a natural, zesty enterprise. Vagina. Vagina.
You mean
quotes? Right. All right, so let's move on. Scene three, we're back to the Nightfires. You know, the Hound gets his weapons, but he doesn't get his gold.
Oh, hell no. No. He gave that up. He gave that up when he got caught.
He gave that up. Well, I mean, at least the Brotherhood, they're like, here, take your weapons.
To be captured by Metax.
Well, explain.
When I capture you, you are so grateful. You give me all your.
Oh, Metax. I was thinking it was like some kind of sci-fi thing you're talking about.
I can do that. I can make some stuff up here.
No, it's fine. Great. So, I mean, you have no problem with this. Yeah, they took his gold. It's a Metax.
Yeah.
You know, you killed their guy.
Yeah.
He came back to us.
Yeah.
But we're going to tax you on that, so we're going to keep all your gold.
All of it.
And send him on his way.
Yeah. Keep his little, you know, dog hat.
Right. The Hound helm.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have Arya fighting for this, you know, like you can't let this guy go.
She's hot. She's hot about this.
She lost. Too bad for her. So, you know, the Hound he's loose.
He is. And I bet we never see him again. And,
ever. And his storyline
is
done.
The end of
right.
The story.
Okay. So, moving on. Now we have scene four. And Jaime is delivered. And, you know, Locke doesn't impress Lord Bolton with the whole hand around Jamie's neck and how he's treated both Brienne and Jamie.
No, he does not. Roose is not amused, I would say.
Not at all. And it's a really weird bit here where Roose Bolton is, I mean, obviously screwing with Jamie. He's the lead in with, you know, your sister is, and I mean, this is
pause for effect.
Right. When it happened, I was like, this is like when you're playing poker with some friends and you put in, you know, you make a big bet and your friend goes, I will fold.
Right. It's a half string bet and half,
right.
Fuck you. I want to see your card.
Right.
I just want you to think you're going to win my money and then not.
And I didn't like this choice, either as the writing. I don't know if it was the writing or the acting or the directing, but it was so painfully obvious to me. And I just didn't dig. I didn't dig what was happening with the scene. I mean, what did you think?
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I think it's okay if Jamie's reaction's a little different. If Jamie doesn't look like he's hanging on every second.
Mm.
I think Jamie's a better liar than that. He's better at, even in a situation like right. that, I think that his pride lets him hide what he's feeling a little better than that.
So
I think
right.
it's okay for Roose to not be this mastermind the way that Tywin is, or the way that Ned
right.
was, or the way that Dany is proving herself to be. I think it's okay for Roose to be a little bit of a buffoon in trying mm-hmm. to prove how smart he is, that he's just not very smart. I'm okay with that.
Right.
You know, if that's where they're going. I think that Jaime is a little better at hiding what's going on in his head than they're allowing him to be.
Now, okay, great.
So I think it's okay for Roose to be obvious in his manipulations.
All right.
Jamie can't look like he knows that he's being obvious, but he can't look as much like he did in thinking that maybe...
Right. Woe is me, is my sister dead?
Yeah, exactly.
And where were they? Do you know for sure?
I think they're in Harrenhal.
You think they're in Harrenhal? Because, I mean, Rob went there. Nobody was there. Everybody was gone. Was Roose with him? And he left him behind?
No, didn't Roos come back later?
I don't remember. That's what so they went there. That's where they found Qyburn. And I asked because Qyburn is in this scene.
Right.
He's the maester attending to Jaime's wound. So, and I don't honestly remember where Roos was in relation to when they found Qyburn at Harrenhal Hall and all the men that had been slain, and if now they're returning to Harrenhal Hall with Jaime.
Well, no, I think what
they're not at the Dreadfort, right?
No, they're definitely not okay. at the Dreadfort. I think what happened in the books, and we never look stuff like this up, guys. So
right, we're going off of pure recollection.
Remember, this is Sports Dork Radio. This is not, this is not facts and well-researched minutiae.
Like facts,
is crap off the top of my head. But if I remember correctly, and I never remember correctly, Roos went back to rule Harrenhal for
right
for Rohan.
Absolutely,
but. I think it was once Ari and them left.
Or, that he left, right.
That Roos stayed there the entire time. So he's been there.
Well, and there was, I mean, because we had the Brave Companions too. And they were at, they had actually taken control of Harrenhal for Rob for a right. period of time. And it may have been, and now that you bring it up, I think it may have been that where... When Jamie's delivered, it's to Vargo Hoked at Harrenhal. But this is one of these perfect
Vargo
moments.
Catches Jaime. He's the Brave Companion.
And he brings it back to Harrenhal then. So this is one of those perfect moments where you can go to email us at theverylazymuse.com, or I mean theverylazymuse at Gmail to let us know how idiotic our recollections are. Our recollections are. So
this one thing happened, and
right.
some other people with swords.
It's a really big book. Yeah, okay? They're it's big. A big, big book. All right, so.
And why does it even matter? Why are we on this? Why are we talking about
okay,
this?
Let's talk about Jaime sucking it up. I mean, he doesn't take milk of the poppy.
No.
It, you know.
Oh, and I love that's a great line. It's a great line. Well, it'll hurt.
Right.
Then I'll scream.
Right, then I'll scream.
It'll hurt very bad. Yeah,
right. And he does. We hear it.
I know the line was wrong. I know, but it's something like that.
Now, please send us comments.
Yes.
So he refuses the milk of the poppy. I mean, what do you think he should have taken it? I mean, is he just being a tough guy? I mean, what do you think about Jaime refusing the milk of the poppy?
I don't know.
You don't know. Come on. I stub my toe and I want a Vicodin. This guy, you know, gets his hand cut off and he refuses the milk of the poppy. And I think the milk of the poppy, in if we translate it, is like, you know, like Oxycontin or a morphine or something. Easily you become addicted to this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I see it, you know, and I'm probably making crap up, but I see it as another of the things that separate Jaime from Tyrion. You know, they grew up as completely different things, and Tyrion doesn't see drugs or alcohol or whores as being something that makes a man weak, and Jaime does.
Right. Well, he doesn't need whores because he's got a sister to fuck.
Oh, yeah. That doesn't make us somebody weak.
No, just gross.
A little gross. Yeah.
All right. So
we've all got perverts inside us, Jaime. I just call him Jaime.
That's right. My family calls me Jaime.
Yes,
we do. I will not deny that. But moving on.
Why
don't
we move on? You uncomfortable?
I am a little uncomfortable.
Right.
So scene five, we have, you know, Cersei putting the screws to Littlefinger.
Yes.
And here's another example of my opinion of Cersei. She is blunt. I mean, she's just a big old club. And there's not much subtlety to her.
Right. I mean, I see Cersei and Peter Baelish as being a perfect match for each other because neither one of them is near as smart as they think they are.
Right.
They're both smart, they're both capable, they're both manipulative, they're both clever. They're not really all that smart. No one looks at the two of them and sees anything other than what they are, which is kind of small time thrown in the big pool.
Mm.
And it's cool to see the two of them go at each other, you know.
Right.
It's not as fun when you see one of them put up against the Queen of Thorns or Tywin Lannister because they're just so obviously outmatched.
Right. So, I mean, it sets it up exactly like you said, with their wits going against each other, and you know, Cersei not making making a not so subtle threat about, you know, you failed me and not finding the Arya girl. Let's hope you don't fail me again. And right. You know, we find out later that, you know, he doesn't fail her.
Yes.
So, it's really just a setup for what we're going to find out he does later. So, as we move on, then we have the Queen of Thorns and Tyrion.
Dame Diana Rigg.
Yes. And this is the scene which made me give the episode to the Tyrells, because I just love how she comes to the rescue here. I mean, they have a nice little banter back and forth. You know, she acquiesces at the end. It's like, fine, you need some money, we'll help you out again.
Right. I talk about it constantly. Diana Rigg is perfect.
Awesome.
There's nothing she can't do. She's, you know, she's Alec Guinness. You know, she's this amazing, amazing actor who can do anything and does not at all feel like it's a shame to be in a piece of kind of pop culture fluff like Game of Thrones can be seen as.
Sure.
And what she's part of what lifts it above that. Anyway, I love her.
Yeah.
I love you, Dame Diana.
Nice scene with two of our favorite actors and characters here. The Queen of Thorns and Tyrion back and forth, and just, you know, lovely play. Tyrion, you know, not trying to do the "you'll give me anything I want." You know, he's playing like a person who really needs something, and he's going after what he needs.
Yes.
And it's very well. It's a fun scene, and I love it. That's why I gave it to House Tyrell. Moving on to scene 7, we have Arya and Gendry saying goodbye.
It's very important.
Arya keeping her pack together, or trying to anyways. And there's, you know, listening to some of the other podcasts and reading some of the boards.
You're a dork.
Right. For some reason, there is this ridiculous confusion about what Gendry says to Arya at the end of the scene. When he says, "We wouldn't be family, you would be my lady."
Right.
And there's some people who are thinking that was like saying, "You're my lady." You know, like it's a love song.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No. And it's so obvious that it's not that.
Those are not good dorks. Those are dorks that don't get it.
Right. I mean, it's the it was so obviously clear that he meant you would
be too far above me. We wouldn't even know each other. You wouldn't know my name. The same kind of things that were bothering Arya very early in the first season, that she didn't want to be a lady. She wanted to hang out with the butcher boy and hang out with, you know, cool people.
Right.
And it's a callback to those kind of feelings, and part of the reason that she has been rebelling against what she was born to be for the whole time.
Exactly. And it's, I thought it was...
So you dorks that thought it was him coming on to her. Yeah, there's some attraction there, and there's some tension.
Of course.
There, but that's not what he's saying.
Right. No. And there's nothing like attraction and tension between some tweeners.
Right. All you need is a little sunlight to make him sparkle.
Man. Yeah. So this was, I think it was a sad moment, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, him saying out loud, "We can't ever really be friends. We are friends by circumstance right now. But even no matter how much you want, you can't elevate me to the level where we can actually be more than what we are now." And Arya just, you know, again, being in a situation where she wants something that is just not possible.
Right.
I feel for her.
We just see her losing everyone that's important to her.
Right.
One by one.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a sad scene for her, but it was really well done by the two young actors. So we move on to scene 8. You know, we have Karstark here. He breaks in.
Rickard.
Yeah, Rickard Karstark, or, you know, evil Santa Claus.
Right.
He breaks in. He kills some of Rob's men. I mean, because they're guarding the door. And then they kill the two little kids. I mean, this is Richard III type of stuff here.
Oh, sure.
I mean, what did you think about this? Because it's obvious that if Rob beheads this guy, he's going to lose a big faction of men.
Yes. You know, what I like most about this scene is how, again, how matter-of-fact it is. It's a plot point that needs to happen because we need to see how the Northern Army is fractured. And this is part of that. They don't spend too much time on it. They don't, you know, these are not kids that we've known long. These are not...
Right. We don't really care about them.
They're just cute little blonde kids. And we have to see one of the good guys kill them so that we don't know who the hell the good guys are.
Right. Right.
And at least so we can retain some semblance of love for Robb Stark, he acts quickly and kills the dude.
Right. He acts like his father would, honorably. He does what is right. But here's, like, let's step outside of even maybe the books, but like just from the point of view of was strategically him beheading the head of one of the strongest parts of his faction. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's the right thing to do.
Right.
And it's absolutely the wrong thing to do.
Right. He's caught between a rock and a hard place.
It's the right thing to do to retain self-respect, and it's the wrong thing to do to be a king.
And so, because even in the series, we have everyone around him really saying, you know, don't do this. His wife, his mom, his uncle, Edmure, is saying, you know, keep him as a prisoner. Hold him hostage until after the war so you don't lose him. But, and I guess that makes a certain amount of sense, but it doesn't take into account that this man, Rickard Karstark, humiliated Rob. Not only did he openly defy him, but in front of everybody, he tells him, you know, the king who lost the North, you're not gonna do anything to me. You're just gonna slap me on the hand and send me away. I mean, he openly is disrespectful, and that's just as bad. You've already lost those men. You have to assume that faction is gone already.
Yeah.
Whether you kill him or not, you've already lost them, or you're going to be looking over your shoulder like, is this, you know, what is this guy going
to
do?
And it stems back to Catelyn, or Catelyn.
However, says, Cat.
Cat, getting the Kingslayer out of prison.
Right. Yeah, I mean, she really screwed. She screwed so much shit up.
Okay.
So I think he absolutely should have cut off his head. Because he was screwed either way. And at least this way, he absolutely knows where and who his enemies are.
Yeah.
Because it's worse to have some guys around you that you don't know if you can trust than it is to,
we'll see very clearly in the next several books.
Right. So, right. And, you know, he takes off Karstark's head cleanly, just like his dad would have done. And he done it himself. You know, like if you're going to sentence a man to death, then do it yourself is what Eddard said.
Parallel to the very first scene of the entire series.
Right. Absolutely. So I'm with him on that.
I guess second scene. The first scene was north of the wall. But it led to the second scene.
Who's the dork now?
I'm a pretty big dork.
All right. So we move on to scene 9. And this is Arya's prayer. I'm glad we got to see this. I don't want anyone to forget that. This is something Arya does. Every night when she goes to bed, she recites the names of the people she's going to kill. And as the books go along, that list gets longer. And woe to you if your name makes that list.
Yeah, she's a very healthy young person.
Nothing
going wrong in the upbringing of this person.
And right. And we get some great exposition here. I mean, I don't feel like we trip into it. It doesn't like smack you in the face. It's fun to listen to. It's natural. I really enjoyed it, the way they bring it about.
Thoros and Beric are really well-written and really well-cast. They're two actors who have a facility with language and a natural kind of ability with each other on screen. They just kind of talk, and that's great for who those two characters are because they're larger than life. But they're not. You know, they're these legendary characters to the other people on the show.
right.
to each other. They're old drinking buddies who find themselves
right.
in a ridiculously untenable situation. And they're just making the best of it. It's a fascinating scene.
Well, yeah. Making the best of, you know, resurrection.
Yeah. But again, matter of fact.
Matter of fact. Six times. Yeah, exactly. How many times has it been?
Five?
Six.
Six.
Yeah, I mean, totally. They're not being precious about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a little bit of hope here for Arya. Like, maybe she will see Rob. You know, they have a debate about, you know, well, why we're doing it. But we're going, you know, and by that I mean Theros is, you know, we need the gold. So, you know, we're going to hold you and then, but we'll get you to Rob.
Right.
He'll take you. He'll give us gold. Everybody wins.
Yes.
So it's, you know, it's nice to see Arya have a little bit of hope. But, man, if we've learned one thing about Hope and Arya Stark is they do not go together.
Yeah, this ain't going to last real long.
Right. So in the scene, we also have a really great moment with Arya after we talk about this matter-of-fact stuff about Theros bringing Beric Dondarrion back six times. And Arya says,
I reversed it. That was awesome. We are not drinking beer for this episode.
Yeah, not yet. So
yeah, that was awesome.
But I mean, it's a really touching moment here where Arya asks if you can bring back somebody who's lost their head.
Yes. And, you know, it's clear right away who she's talking about. And, you know, it's clear to them too, you know, a little knowing look to
right.
each other and then.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, and they you can tell they feel for her. They know that this is, you know, the wish of a young girl. And it really does come across as this is something that an 11-year-old would ask. And it's just a great line when she says, well, I don't want you to do it six times. I just want you to do it once.
Right.
I mean, it sounds like a kid. It's delivered like a kid, and it really made my heart go out.
It reminds us that she is a kid.
Right. And, you know, just very touching. And it's nice to see that there's these real emotions in there, that it's not just revenge and fighting, that, you know, there's the want of this little kid to have her dad back.
Right.
So I really love that. I think it would have been a close runner up for me to give it to House Stark for the episode because of the touching moment there.
Yeah.
But the Queen of Thorns trumped her.
Yeah.
So then we go back. Now we're at scene 10. And we get to meet Celeste, Stannis' real queen.
Yes.
And
I mean, he's not a real king. So
right.
Be
right.
A real queen.
But, I mean, yeah. This lady is cray-cray.
Oh, yeah. No, and that's why they did what they did with the babies in jars.
Right, you which know? Is...
It's a kind of shorthand, if you will, which we've seen recently with the governor in Walking Dead.
Right, exactly.
You know, when you keep body parts in jars that have some special meaning for you, you are not a normal person.
Right.
And we don't have to waste any time establishing that. We can just show a picture
right.
of fetuses in jars.
So, yeah.
Boom.
And
crazy.
Yeah, boom, crazy, and crazy cool kind of way to throw in some exposition, because
yep.
you have to explain the babies in the jars,
yeah.
And, you know, to show that I tried to give you sons, and this is what happened when I tried. I'm glad that you're having success with the priest, and, you know, good for you that your religious figurehead is your reason to have extramarital affairs,
right.
and your wife's cool with it, man.
Yeah, your crazy nut job of a wife is
right.
fine with you.
It's just okay.
You know, trying to impregnate your crazy nut job of a priest.
And that your babies are, you know, demonic smoke babies that kill people.
Yes.
Good on you. And so then we also meet his daughter.
Oh, I love her.
You know, we got the grayscale. And what did you...
Possibly the nicest person in all of the books.
Right.
All of them.
Right.
Is his daughter. Is Stannis' disfigured, Princess Daughter.
Right. And what did you think about the effect here? I mean, this is the first time we've seen grayscale. Right. And
which is basically leprosy. I mean, you know, right. With a little magic thrown in.
Right. Well, man, what do you mean, magic? You think it's magic that she has the grayscale? I mean, it looks like a scale, but it's just like molted skin that's hard. They describe it in a book like it's like
right,
wood.
But they describe it more in a couple books, a couple seasons down the line. We'll see more of it with Tyrion and.
See, now I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, well, because you don't remember as much as you think you do.
No, well, I don't remember anything.
And it seems to me to be treated. The people with it are treated much the way that we treat lepers historically.
Right.
In our world.
Well, especially this. She's like, it seems like, and they don't say it, but it seems like in this episode, she's almost like a prisoner. She's held away from everybody else up in, you know, some tower cell.
Right.
You know, and she's singing a song that we, you know, we know from the books. Yes. But, you know, not.
Which we don't get to hear the duet.
Right, we don't...
Because fuck you for not giving me Patch Face.
We don't have Patch Face.
I want Patch Face. I want him. I want him and Strong Belwas, and I will not stop harping on it until the show is over. I want to be the very last episode of the very last season of this show just to appease me and people like me, because we are Legion, and we want Patch Face.
We want him. We want somebody in Motley. I mean, there's nobody in Motley in this show.
They didn't even do anything with... what's his name, did they?
I know what you're talking about, and no, they did not. I don't remember his name either, though.
Yeah, what's his name?
The one who works for the Queen of Thorns.
Yeah.
Are you talking about? Oh, well, there's two. There's Dantos.
Dantos, yeah.
Who? He's out because he's out at least for now because he's the one in the books who's actually like.
Right, but we can't talk much about this.
Blah 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 blah. We're gonna blah 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 blah.
We'll talk about this in the next.
So. No Dantos, no fool for the Queen of Thorns, no fool for...
They did show Dantos get ill in the first season at the Hand's Tourney, though.
Right, they did.
But then they never really brought him back.
Because he's not a real fool. They did not... I don't remember, but...
I don't remember.
He's not a Motley fool.
Are we completely forgetting this character?
Let's go, we can check out a Wiki of Ice and Fire.
How are you going to get the dorks to listen to this, by the way? Are you putting the word out?
I'm putting the word out, the intrawebs.
Yeah.
I am posting to the Ice and Fire Facebook page.
Okay, good.
So hopefully we'll get some of that attention.
The term dorks that I use, dorks, is very...
Loving.
Loving, it is. I consider myself one, and I'm taking the word back. So we're
good
dorks.
Good for you. The Quentin Tarantino of dorks.
All dorks that are listening to this, enjoy yourself, man. Email us at
theverylazymuse@gmail.com.
All right, so let's get on to
Brienne's butt.
Brienne's butt. You have seen this bit, haven't you?
Yeah.
Can I start?
Please do.
I would start this by saying that this piece of slight and possibly tasteful nudity is one of the things I'm talking about that is actually important to the relationships on screen.
Yes.
Jaime Lannister has been treating Brienne like he thinks that she wants to be a man. And she denies it in her own way. But I think it's important that we don't get to see her like this in a clearly feminine moment until after he has already started to warm to her. He has already shown her, for the first time of any character in the book that he's not distinctly related to, kindness.
Right.
Empathy. Comradeship.
Yes.
Any sort of warmth. The first person we've seen that he's not related to, that he's showed that to, is Brienne. And he did it while he was, or after he had made fun of her before, he sees her in a position of vulnerability. Does that make sense?
It does. It's very intelligently said, and there are far too many qualifications for nudity.
I don't know what that means.
I mean, that's...
You just wanted to see her butt.
There's way too many qualifications to justify nudity in what you just said.
What do you mean? Of course you can justify nudity with that.
Well, I know. I agree. I'm saying it's very well said.
I'm not justifying it.
It's but there's too many of those things to hit.
People are naked in real life
for you to enjoy nudity. Other than the fact that you know, so what? Show the ass.
Everybody,
I don't care why.
I do care why.
Just show it.
Because it's more powerful.
Do the whole show naked. I don't care.
Yes, people are naked in everyday life all the time.
Right.
Yes.
For no other reason than they want to be.
Nudity in this show is sexualized, which is great. I love sex and sexualized nudity. Great. Awesome. But in storytelling, use it for something the way they do here. I'm sorry I'm hitting the table while I'm trying to make this point, but I think it's an important point.
It is, but it's just way too highbrow for my liking.
All right, cool, fine.
So we have Brienne's butt.
We do.
Nice butt. It's not the first butt we've seen this episode. I mean, we got a good butt count this episode.
Yes.
And there's some really great stuff here.
It's a great scene.
Again, a little more exposition that's very satisfying. I mean, so your gut reaction to the Kingslayer's confession here.
I like it. I wish, and it's one of the only problems I have ongoing with how the show is filmed. I wish that this was a scene where they showed on screen both of them while he's giving his speech. I am not a fan of the ubiquitous close-up. And this show is all about close-up after close-up after close-up after close-up. And it waters down the importance of a speech like this. So I think in a moment like this, it would be nice to see a wide shot where you can see both of their faces and feel the rhythms between both actors.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
As opposed to just on his face.
Very theatrical.
With the occasional cutaway.
Right.
That's all I want. And I'm sorry, I think you guys do a great job. I want less close-ups.
Okay, so cinematography aside, what about the storytelling?
Yeah, well done. I like it.
Yeah, me too. I agree. I didn't think about the way it was shot, but bringing it up, I see your point. I liked it still, you know, the close-up with him. It gave me a sense of how dirty he was to see, like, his eyes kind of had that look of, you know, being tired and bloodied and beat up, which gave me a sense of this guy's been through the ringer for a year now.
Sure.
And I just love his reveal. I mean, he hasn't shared this story, we don't know, with anybody other than Bryn. Brienne, sorry.
Sorry, Bryn.
He hasn't shared. We don't know who else he shared his with. He certainly didn't tell Eddard and any of these other people.
No, I think he makes a point that he's never told anyone about.
Right, and the great thing is because he's never cared. Like, he doesn't care what you think about him. You call him the Kingslayer, and you by you I mean, you know, anybody.
Of course he cares.
Not enough that he wants to justify it. Rolls off his back.
He doesn't think it'll do any good.
Well, and there, I think he's, from his point of view, they're beneath him. It's like, you're nothing to me, so
yeah.
You might as well call me Poopy Pants or the air or the sun. It's like, what you say has no effect to me, on me.
He does care. Most people who have that attitude care very deeply.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Freud.
Just, you know, if we're going to assume that this guy is a deep character, and we have to because he's one of the main characters that we'll be following.
Right.
Then we have to assume that he thinks, whether he wants to or not, he's capable of the kind of gray area thinking that means that he does care about this kind of stuff. And that he's been trying so hard for so long to look like he doesn't. And that he's lost a hand, he's naked and dirty and disgusting. Sitting across from the one person who's seen him vulnerable and weak in his entire life.
Right, right, right. Very important.
He finds himself able to unload this massive burden.
I see where you're going with that. I agree. I think that if he's only unloading it because of the physical condition he's in, it's not, for me, as powerful.
No, it's
because it seems to me more of he respects Brienne, and like you said, camaraderie. So he's confiding into her, to her, something he's never confided to anybody because of that camaraderie, not because, you know, I feel weak and I've lost my hand.
Right. No, it's, but it's both. You know, it's with anybody else other than his sister and possibly his brother.
Right.
Losing his hand makes him a bigger asshole.
And I think maybe the connection he has with Brienne here is perhaps even deeper than what he has with Cersei and Tyrion.
Oh, I
because
think so. Sure.
It's a honest choice.
Yeah.
It's not for blood. It's
yeah.
I like
brand
who you
new,
are.
Brand new we're seeing
Slayer. Right. And it's in that true moment. Because, you know, confession is a confession. You know, he opens up and he confesses something that honestly it makes you – it sort of justifies who he was. Because, yeah, he killed the king. But the king – you know, so what? He was the king. He was a dirtbag. He was burning people alive. He wanted to burn the whole city because he was losing his kingdom. So, you know what? He deserved to get cut down. And no vow should keep you from, you know, taking the correct course of action.
Absolutely.
But here at the end of the scene, we see, you know, when he like faints and Brienne yells out, "The Kingslayer." And he says, "My name is Jaime." And to me, that was the most touching point because, like, the confession is whatever makes me look nice, but my name is Jaime. To her specifically, is anybody else can call me Kingslayer. I want you to call me Jaime.
It's important that you see me for me.
Right.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, we're getting very deep into this because we're kind of jackass.
We're dorks.
Dorks, yes.
Right.
So. Enjoy or don't.
Well, I think anybody who watches this show probably love that too.
Yes.
Like they
yes.
love that moment. They found it touching.
Yes.
Even if you haven't read the books, that him saying "My name is Jaime" is just a really
moment.
Touching moment, and it shows, you know, that these two are together now. Like
yes.
it's they're gonna watch out for one another.
Yes.
Okay, so moving on to scene 12, we have, you know, Davos is visited by his princess.
How do you say Davos? Are they saying Davos or Davos?
No, I think it is Davos, actually. It sounds
the
better,
Onion
too.
Knight.
Right, the Onion
or
Knight.
The Onion Knight. Let's call it the Onion.
So Davos is visited by his princess. And, you know, so we have her taking over the role that the Maester had in book 2, where he was teaching Davos how to read.
Right.
But that same Maester was killed when he tried to poison Melisandre. So now we have her teaching him how to read. And,
yeah,
you know.
It's nice that, again, it's good that this wholly good character of the princess. Considers herself friends with one of the only other kind of completely honorable characters in the book,
right.
who is the Onion Knight.
And she only calls him that. Like,
yes.
She only...
Where's my Onion Knight?
The Onion Knight. Onion Knight, I'm here to see you, Onion Knight.
Yeah.
But I don't think the scene had a whole lot to offer. I mean, it was nice. We get to see, I love this guy, the actor. And, you know, we see somebody reaching out to him. And it's really just setting some stuff up.
Right.
For a little bit later on. So,
yeah.
So we move on to Danny marches into
Yunkai.
And he, we get a little bit of game playing here between Jorah and Barristan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they both know exactly who the other is.
Right.
They know all the good and all the bad.
I mean, and Jorah, he's probing here. He wants to know, like, oh, did you sit on the small council?
Yeah, did you know why I was sent here?
Right. And, you know, he drops the whole slave thing, and,
yeah.
you know, like, oh, everybody knows about that. I mean, and this is some gamemanship here.
Yeah.
Does Barristan know that Jorah
was a spy,
and he was supposed to kill Dany? And he was going to, and then didn't.
And what I really like about this scene is we see a side of Barristan we haven't seen before. Kind of the enormous amount of relief he feels to be serving under Dany finally.
Right.
You know, he's
right.
smiling, he's joking, he's reminiscing. You know, he's a completely
yep.
different guy than
right.
than he was under Robert or under Joffrey.
or under Eris.
Right, we haven't seen that.
Right, but I mean, he talks about that, yes. Like how exactly what you're saying, that now he finally gets to serve somebody that it's an honor to serve.
Yeah.
And
it's a great way he puts it, and this is in the book too, you know, Robert, great warrior, bad king.
Right, right, yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, and Barristan doesn't say he knows, but it seemed to me that he knows.
There's a withholding there that's, right. That's fun to watch.
And he's it's curious, if he has knowledge, you know, why not come out with it?
Well, yeah, any number of reasons.
Right.
I like it.
I mean, we've read the book, so we know what the outcome of that knowledge is. But in the scene here, it really had a feeling of, I know something. And
well,
so
by
it begs.
We know all kinds of shit y'all don't know.
Right.
Now, you other dorks, you know what I'm talking
it's
about.
It's about to get cray cray.
All you other fuckers, you don't know what you're in for.
No.
So read the damn books.
But we get introduced to Grey Worm here.
Yes, one of my favorites.
A great character.
One of my favorite characters.
And I think. I never really thought about what Graham. To be honest, all the Unsullied looked the same to me, like a bunch of high-voiced eunuchs.
Well, and here's something you might not know. Depending on when a eunuch is shorn,
right?
You know, your voice doesn't revert to a high tenor.
But aren't these are all they're taken as kids?
Right, but it depends on when.
So if they're at five,
fine, it stays. High longer than you'd expect, but the biology of it has as much to do with lengthening vocal cords as it does with anything down there.
So if you're 5 years old and you get shorn,
right.
At 23, your voice still may drop.
Absolutely.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
The reason that we talk about a lot of the I don't know why I know this shit, but the reason we talk about that kind of stuff is, you know, we're mostly familiar with the phenomenon of the castrati singer.
Right.
You know, and it was a thought that you would be able to maintain that high voice through, you know, completely misunderstood biology of the time.
All right. Good.
And actually, there's all kinds of strange facts about...
Castration
in a series of books by Arianna Franklin, who's a terrific fiction writer, who has a series of books about the Mistress of the Art of Death, which takes place during Henry II's reign in England and follows the adventures of a young Sicilian woman who had studied to become a medical doctor and does autopsies in medieval England. And it's one of her assistants is an Islamic and it's a really fantastic series of books. If you have not read them, dorks, go out and get
right. And this is proof positive. Proof positive that we do not mean anything disparaging by the term dork, because that was a gigantic dork moment.
Yes, I have my absolute dork moment. Anyway, Arianna Franklin, fantastic writer.
Great.
Right, moving on.
Back to Grey Worm. A really nice introduction of this guy. Love the dialogue right from the book about, you know, I had a name when I was, right, taken as a slave. And, you know, this is a name I had when, you know, Daenerys Stormborn freed me. With just a couple of lines, we get to see, I mean, because really this is the mouthpiece for 8,000 people. He's speaking for the Unsullied.
Yes.
We can assume that this is you know, the opinion of every single one of those other men there. And they have some people who really do love this lady. Like, they feel...
Well, and I always thought it was lucky that she chose one who is so well-spoken and thoughtful.
Right.
You know, God, that's a piece of luck.
Well, they chose him. Like, they, you know, they said, you're the guy. You're going to be the one who's the top dog. So, Grey Worm. We'll see more of him.
I want to see... You know, it seems like this make me want to see... background on the Unsullied. I want to see not only their training when they're looked at by the masters, but I want to see moments stolen among two Unsullied to see what they talk about.
Oh, right.
Do you know?
Yep.
This is what I would have liked to have seen. And not. I don't think they should have done it, and I don't think that it should be in the books. I just want to see those two characters if they were real people.
No, I think that's a good point. That could be like background stuff. As two people are walking past the soldiers, you can see them doing their stuff.
I want to see how they did it.
Oh, when they were, right. And Astapor, right. Okay, so moving on to scene 14. We have Rob figuring out what he's going to do. He's at his big map there. He's talking with his lady love, the Queen of the North. You know, she doesn't know where Winterfell is.
That's true.
So they, you know, he takes her hand and he shows her where it is. And then, you know, suddenly has an epiphany. I know what I need to do.
What do I need to do, Rob?
He needs to go to Walter Frey and say,
Walder
Frey.
Because he's not like a lawyer.
Right.
Like
he's not a lawyer. Yeah. He goes to Walder.
Yeah.
And I should have known that because all of his kids are named Walder.
Oh, yeah.
He's got to make amends.
Yes.
And, I mean, they don't go into detail about what he does, just that I need to go to the twins.
Yeah. The twins, by the way, it's the towers that Walder rules over the easiest ford of the biggest river.
Right, and you can't cross whatever mountain that is without going through there. So he's risen to some level of power because he basically owns the road.
Yeah.
He's the toll.
Owns the river. The Lannisters own the gold and the...
Right. What do the Starks really do then? I mean, the Starks kind of guard the wall? I mean, is that their thing?
Yeah, they live...
Do they have a resource?
They live where nobody else wants to live. I understand there's a bunch of trees up there.
There's trees, so they're... they provide building material?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of beaver
what do they...
to find their way south.
Right, what? Yeah. But they're still an old, powerful family. So, he's going to go off to the twins. And, you know, hopefully that'll...
Today, I would guarantee there's a lot of oil up in them dark. The Alaska.
Black gold.
Of Westeros.
You know, and it really was so idiotic about me. I had Walder typed here on my show notes. And
I saw
Walder.
I saw that.
So moving on to scene 15, we got a little TNA for the other half, meaning some gratuitous sex for the ones who want to see the guy meet.
Yeah, there's plenty of Loras on Oliver action.
Right, and you know, so another butt shot here.
Yes.
Of Oliver.
And really what was amazing about this little seduction is how obvious it was. You know?
Right.
It's not like there was any subtlety involved in this, which is, I think, the right choice, because Loras is a moron, and we know this.
It's just flaming.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he doesn't have a lisp, but, I mean, we'll talk in the next episode about, I mean, this guy is like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy gay.
Right, and that's fine. It's just it's gonna end poorly for him.
Right,
all of these.
I guess maybe it's not fine though, because in the books in the books there was allusions to.
No, in the books.
No, it was allusion. Yeah, no, but it was never. There's never a scene where any kind of sexual. Anyone can write in, but I would bet that it's not. There's only sort of snarky remarks made by other point of view characters.
Moments between him and Renly.
But Renly doesn't have a point of view chapter, so how would that happen?
Right.
So, I mean, there's no... It would have to be a point of view chapter where somebody walked in on them. Mm. So I'm confident that there's actually no physical... scene where you see the homosexuality, but what you do see that where there are physical, there's very well written scenes where you see how much of a badass Loras is.
Oh yeah, which we
with
have
sword and lance. I mean, he beats the mountain in a lancing competition. He beats Jaime Lannister.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant swordsman, and I feel like they've really hit home that this guy's gay, but they haven't shown that he's feared.
Yeah,
with a sword.
This is part of what I'm talking about when I talk about the kind of tendency towards clumsy storytelling, and it's the same reason that we had the babies in jars. because it is an important plot point that Loras Tyrell is gay. It's an important plot point.
Now, so why is it important?
Well, because all throughout the books, that's how he is going to go down. That's that all throughout the books, it's obvious that when he falls, it's going to be because people find out about all this stuff. That's the threat with that character. The same way the incest is the threat between Jamie and Cersei.
So, and I never got
and
that.
It's really horrible that's the equivalency that these two families make. Something that there's no reason to be at all.
Right. Well, and the Tyrells don't seem to have a problem with him being gay.
They don't. But the rest of the kingdom will. Is the
It's interesting you say that because I never got that out of the book, and
well,
you did.
We'll talk about it in the next episode.
Right, we'll bring that. So let's hold off on that.
But no, it's important to note that I think the reason they're harping on it so hard, and that right now there's only one side to Loras Tyrell, and that's
right.
The fact that he's gay.
Right, right.
The reason they're doing that, and I think it's a mistake, is that they feel like it's an important plot point that they want to make sure we don't miss. So they give him a gay sex scene.
Right. We certainly can't miss it. I mean,
Well, no, and that's what I'm saying. I think it's useful when you're talking about establishing that a minor character like Stannis's queen is crazy. It's a quick shorthand to show babies in jars.
Right.
But you don't need to show the waiter winking at Loras and having it turn 2 seconds later into post-coital banter. You know, it's a little clumsy.
Okay.
I think it's fine and probably necessary to show the post-coital banter. I just don't think you need to be so obvious about the oh my God.
Right.
Did that man just wink at him?
And a little bit more.
Right.
Okay, so moving on to the scene 16, we have Peter Baelish, Littlefinger, test Sansa, and you know, Sansa fails his test.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he puts out some feelers there to see if she still wants to go back with him, and she tells him, you know what, maybe we should put that off. We should stick around King's Landing a little bit longer.
Oh, yeah. No, she's the one person who doesn't quite realize what's going on with Loras. You know, they're tempting her with the possibility of that match. She's still in love with the myth of this amazing fighter, which means to her that, of course, he loves women because he's a big fighter. You know, because she's a moron.
Right. He's very gallant.
Yeah.
And he, you know, she's terrible at this game.
Yes, because she's honest and...
Well, and just dense. I mean, she doesn't see danger right in front of her face.
Well, she was, you know, from the beginning, not schooled in anything. She was schooled in walking and needlepoint. And it's a painful education that we see with her, but we see it.
So do you think that, because I would say that cunning is something that you're born with. It could be taught and you see examples of it. But I don't necessarily think that the other players we've seen in this game, like I don't think Peter Baelish was taught how to be cunning. I mean, he was from a low family, and he's built his way up because I think of a natural skill.
A between, you know, classroom teaching and life teaching, I think his life taught him to be cunning, certainly.
Because of the way he was treated, or?
Because of where he was growing up. He didn't grow up at home. He grew up hundreds of miles away.
With the Tullys
as a foster something with no...
Yeah, what was he? Because he wasn't... He was never with the hopes of being elevated.
Right. It's a weird thing, you know? It's the same, you know...
Right.
Cersei learns cunning the same way Tyrion learns cunning through the incredible... lack of affection by
her father.
Right. Mother and, you know,
okay. Well, still, I feel like the Starks are kind of lacking in any ability to really play.
By finding herself alone in the north with all of these.
But do you think she has cunning? I don't think she has any cunning at all.
It's a different kind, but certainly Jane doesn't have any.
No, it's just.
Eddard didn't have any.
Yeah, no, just honor. Like, there is, I'll do what I think is right.
Yeah, which is and, a good way to end up dead.
Yeah, right. Okay,
and
so.
In every world. Listen to that, dorks. Don't do what you think is right just because it's hard. Take the easy way out. Manipulate people.
Right, you know, very Machiavellian. You know, it's so, in another nice scene for Peter here where he just, it shows again how wonderfully slimy he is. I mean, this guy is just a worm.
Yes. Not a gray worm.
So yeah, I mean, he knows what he knows the deal is. He learns about he's already learned from Oliver about, you know, what the Tyrells have planned for Sansa.
Right.
And goes to Sansa to test her to see what she wants. And now he's, you know, he's going to screw her over. You just know it. You know he's going to screw this chick over. All right, so moving on to our final scene. You know, Sansa gets a new love.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Tyrion being told, you're going to marry Sansa Stark.
Right, and his reaction is perfect.
Perfect. I mean, tell us about it.
Well, he immediately goes through the list of all the crap she's already gone through.
Right.
And then says, to reward her, you give her to me. That's unbelievably
cold. Right. It's unbelievably cold. Which, in the book, yes, it's cold. On the TV show, we got a good-looking short guy.
Well, yes, but no.
No. He's a good-looking short guy.
I'm not saying he's not good-looking. I'm right. saying that that's not the way the world views this guy. You know better.
No way. This guy... Chicks dig Peter Dinklage. They think he's hot.
This is you're talking about this world.
No, it doesn't matter.
Talking about Westeros. Come on, don't fall into the fame hole.
No.
You're falling into the fame hole.
I'm not falling into the fame hole. I'm not falling into it. This guy is attractive looking. He's not monstrous looking. So this isn't some horrible matchup. This isn't any worse than some girl being married off to some fat, slobbering fool. And this happens to these people all the time. In this world, you're told to marry whoever makes it the alliance in your family stronger.
He's known as the imp.
He's in the book.
I'm talking about that world.
Right. But the book world and the TV world are very different.
No, they're not.
They are. In terms of the way he looks,
treat him well,
they're very different.
Who have we seen...
It doesn't matter. They just written it that way, not because it's the way
so
he would be
just
treated.
The way someone looks is all that matters.
Not all that matters, but it makes a big deal when he's not as vile looking as he is in the book. This isn't as bad of a matchup as it was in the book.
Yes.
How so?
Because he's still the same character. He's still viewed the world over as an asshole. Dwarf.
They're written to view that way, but he's not. He physically doesn't look bad. In the book, he's horrible looking.
Meaning
he has two different colored eyes. He actually has no nose at this point. The scar is bigger. He waddles when he walks. So a 16-year-old girl looking at this disgusting, misshapen person.
A 16-year-old girl with the background of Sansa Stark is going to look at...
It's much more dramatic.
At Tyrion, played by Peter Dinklage, even.
Differently.
And going to just want to run to get married.
Not that it would make her happy. Not that she thinks he's comparable to the attractiveness of Loris. But
I think you're
he's not
I
as...
I think you're letting the fact of the actor get in the way of the fact of the character.
I absolutely am, because the fact that the actor looks so good and they haven't done the makeup to make him look bad has an effect on the way he's supposed to be really viewed.
When the paragon of beauty in the world of this show is represented by Jaime Lannister with both hands in his shining white cloak standing next to Tyrion, no matter how attractive Peter Dinklage is as a person, that's a huge difference, and that is going to be a huge thing for Sansa.
It's not that big of a difference.
Wrong.
No way. You're wrong.
You're wrong.
You have no point there at all.
Yeah.
So, anyways, it's okay. It's okay to be wrong. I mean, so this is like a wedding season here. And now, and we have an even better lesbian matchup than Loras and Sansa. We have Loras and Cersei. Now, this is a great tickle fight in the making here. This is like MILF stuff here. The older woman, the younger girl, meaning Loras, paired off to one another. And what's so wonderful about the scene is Cersei's smug look all the way through. Until Daddy, drops the bomb on her. And it just makes it so much fun to see her go from smug to what?
Yes.
This is a big departure from the book.
Right. It's not going to happen.
It can't.
It would change everything. It's not gonna
happen. Does he really expect Loras to, give them children? Tywin, I mean?
People have been doing that for
That's true.
Thousands of years.
That's true. You mean the gay guy and yeah.
Yeah, or gay woman, for thousands of years through forced marriages and
right.
whether it's forced by family or forced by society, people have been having
children good point.
In a fashioned way for thousands of years.
So, there's a little bit here at the end when Tywin alludes to the fact, he knows about these rumors in quotation marks of Cersei and Jaime. I took a bit of he paints it as it's just a rumor and we'll put that to bed. But, how does her being with Loras put the incest rumors to bed any more than her being with Robert Baratheon?
Right. It doesn't.
So, does Tywin know?
Yeah.
And he just doesn't want to admit it.
Right. I mean, would you? What's he going to do? Punish him? How?
Kill him?
Yeah, he's not going to kill his kids.
Yeah, he can't kill his kids. Well, I don't even know that he likes them. It's like the only two that he has that he can tolerate because they didn't kill his wife like he thinks Tyrion did. But we're really seeing Tywin take the mantle of douchebaggery here that he has in the books.
Oh yeah.
All right. So that's it. That was the final scene of the episode. Don't worry, we're
we're ending that one with kind of a.
We're not really fighting, guys. Mom and Dad are perfectly happy. Yeah. So that was episode 5, Kiss yes. by Fire. I'm Jimmy G.
I'm Eric Grattan.
And you can find me on Twitter at TheLazyNews.
And I'm around on at TotallyKidding. Or you can find me on Pine Tar Press under the column heading Obstructed Review.
And what's the latest article?
I just put one up about... the recent spate of comic book movies,
mm-hmm.
how we actually seem to be on the road towards figuring out how to do it well.
Some good ones.
Recently, the last 4 or 5 years, we've had a few good ones after,
awesome.
40 years of wasteland crap.
Right. So this is a great column that Eric puts out. Please take some time, check it out. A lot of links. So it's fun to follow where his mind was going when he was writing it and having, some flashbacks because there's always some great old movies in there. I would expect in this article we'll find it there too. As we said earlier in the podcast, you can send us any comments, corrections, rants, anything you want.
How much we're assholes.
Right.
How brilliant we are if you're a moron.
Right.
Bring it out.
So you can do that by emailing us at theverylazymuse@gmail.com.
Very lazy.
And we are officially on iTunes, so please go to iTunes. You can search us by typing in The Lazy Muse and subscribe. Doesn't take up any space on your media device. And please give us some comments and some stars. Even one star. Doesn't matter. Having some stars is important.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. This is The Lazy Muse. We'll see you next time.